Hello and welcome to The Affairs Current. My name, as always, is Coder Vance, your host. Our email is theaffairscurrent@gmail.com. Our blog, theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com, coming to at you today, recording at the end of October of 2016, and hopefully after we did that special with Isaac, trying to get back onto a normalized recording schedule here, and recording live for the third time in the podcast history, and I think now that at sort of less geographic space between me and my co-host, we can have more of a free interchange of ideas that's not interrupted by Skype and such things. So today we're going to be talking about a couple of topics, the first of which is, I guess, a year in review of the first year of the Trudeau government. This has been an interesting week for thinking about that, so I think now is the time. Then the second, a little bit, we're going to talk about Mosul and what's going on there. But who do I have with me to discuss these issues?
Well, it's me, Edward Rouet, once again. Lost track of how many times I've been on, but I mean, you people know who I am.
Okay, perfect. I guess we'll get started here with a year in review of the Trudeau government. So it's been just over a year since Trudeau was elected. The Liberals got their majority. And I remember, you know, we had a few episodes throughout the course of the podcast that touched on this. Of course, immediately after the election, you and I did a kind of, right after he announced the cabinet. Well, we did immediately after the election. We said, okay, like, what does this mean electorally for the parties? And then after he announced the cabinet, we talked about that. And then I had Taylor on to discuss after the first budget dropped. And I think, you know, both because it's been a year since they were elected, and also because some events that happened this week that I'll talk about, it's an interesting moment to kind of look back on what the first year has brought. So I think, just to kind of roll back a little bit, I think, you know, when that budget came out on the podcast, and I think broadly speaking, I think the budget was pretty well received. Of course, there were, if people do remember, the same day was also the day of the terrorist attacks in Brussels, and also the day that Rob Ford died, so it ended up being a pretty packed news day, so maybe the budget kind of got washed from it, but I seem to recall that, like, and even looking at it myself, I think there was a broadly positive reception to it. People seemed, okay, we're going back on a different, more investment-driven track in terms of government policy coming out of the Harper years. And that was, you know, broadly in a sort of honeymoon period for the government, and people seemed to be thinking positively, okay, you know, things are moving in the right direction. And then a number of things started happening. I think, let's work in, like, sort of reverse chronological order starting from this. So this week, I think, is where you've started to maybe see some of these come out into the open in a lot more vivid terms. The first thing that's happened, and it seems to, and this is, like, breaking as we talk about this, there was a real impasse in getting the CETA agreement passed. Wallonia, the Walloon Parliament, sort of blocked that. Now, it appears that they've manage some kind of resolution measure, but then it needs to be approved by the other EU members. So the real question, which Trade Minister Chrystia Freeland really made a point of pushing this as a part of the Liberal agenda, that is questionable as well. On trade, you have the question, TPP is still very much up in the air, although that's also related to things about the US election. But anyway, and then going back one other day, Trudeau was at this Canadian Labour Congress Young Workers Forum, where he received a very, let's say, testy reaction from the audience there. Many people turned their backs on him, asked some very critical questions, were heckling him, because the day before that, Finance Minister Bill Morneau made a number of comments about, like, precarious work and sort of people just sort of having to get used to things being the way they are in terms of that for young people. And then, you know, if we want to go back further than that, there was the stuff about the LNG project. There was the stuff about continuing approvals of the Site C dam and all these kind of things. So I guess, and then, of course, on Monday, we had the first mass arrest of the Trudeau era.
I should say, you know, full disclosure here, I actually participated in that action. It was a civil disobedience action on Parliament Hill, where I and 98 other activists were arrested, basically to protest specifically the Kinder Morgan pipeline, urge the government to reject it. And also more generally, really any pipelines. One of the slogans we marched under was keep it in the ground. So, you know, me and 98 others were arrested and issued citations for trespassing. You know, just I personally cannot go back on Parliament Hill for 3 months, so I guess I'm going to miss the Christmas lights. But anyway, so yeah, so full disclosure, I was involved in that.
Yeah, so and that's just to say, you know, the first real big mass arrest of the Trudeau. So from a certain perspective, you could say that it seems like the wheels are kind of coming off of this narrative. But if the other hand, if you look at the polling, they are still riding high. In fact, they are more popular now than they were when they got elected. I think the current poll shows that about something like 51% of people would vote for the Liberals if the election were held today. Mm-hmm. Broadly speaking, Prime Minister Trudeau and his government remain popular within the wider public. And then, of course, there is this bizarre infatuation that, like, the Vox.com crowd and other kind of liberal outlets from other countries seem to have with Trudeau, presenting him as this more progressive voice in the world. So I guess all this kind of adds up to a very interesting kind of conundrum about where this government is going to go from here. Now, we have on next Tuesday, we're going to have a finance update from Bill Morneau, which is kind of being pitched as a mini budget that's going to set some new infrastructure project priorities. And it seems like that is kind of an attempt maybe to pivot off of some of this recent more negative coverage and get them back on the right track in terms of public perception. But I guess to kind of broadly sum this up, where do you see the public mood as being, but then also where do you think the shifts in what the government has been doing speak to what it's actually going to be like for the next 3 or 4 years?
So I think that, well, for one thing, I think it's kind of hard to say exactly where the public mood is right now, just because I don't know how recent some of the polling was that puts them so high. I'm not saying that, like, things that all the things you actually just outlined over the past week are going to, like, that this is going to be the thing that, like, finally punctures the honeymoon. But I will be interested to see, like, once the news coming out of this week has had a chance to sink in, what impact that has on public perception. But in an actual policy sense, I do think we are kind of finally getting to the point where, you know, they're actually moving from consultation, or as they would probably like to put it, or slash, you know, working on drafting legislation, to actually acting and making decisions. Because, I mean, frankly, if we'd done this podcast, like, I don't know, like even just a couple of weeks ago, I would probably still be saying it's too early to really start judging the Liberals and their record. And, I mean, indeed, you know, we still have a lot of major decisions, which, as much as they're sort of signaling where they're going to go with them, we have not actually have yet to actually come down. But yeah, this will, I think, in part speak to why. I mean, this is, and again, I will say, part of why I myself took part in this civil disobedience action on Monday, is that we do seem to be seeing a lot of signals from the government that now it's actually coming time to make decisions on, you know, pipelines, on stuff like that, that they are sort of leaning in a more, I don't know how you would put it, sort of right-wing sort of...
I think they're leaning in a direction that's basically in continuity with a lot of what the Harper government was doing on that issue. Although, one thing I will say, although I think we sort of diagnosed this even back when they were coming out of the climate change agreements that they had, was that they basically, along with, you know, I'll be frank and say there is this idea that's shared amongst them and a tendency that is most broadly represented by, like, the Alberta NDP government, that the solution is basically carbon pricing plus pipelines.
That's true. So we called it. If they start announcing they're going to support Kinder Morgan, we called it, just saying.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that's sort of broadly what the policy on that framework is going to be. And, I mean, I think that was actually kind of signaled. But I think you may be right that, like, part of why it's sort of coming to a head now is because they have to actually start making the decisions, right? Because it's one thing to do this sort of tea leaf reading exercise where you try to figure out, okay, this is the exact terms they're using, what could that indicate, etc. But, like, once the rubber hits the road and, like, pipelines actually start getting built or approved or not approved or whatever it may be, that's where people really start to notice where the policy is leading and what sort of framework it's working in and the kind of end logic of it, right?
Yeah, and we do, and like there are a lot of sort of deadlines, both statutory and just sort of in terms of what the government has promised that are coming up. So, I mean, like the approval of Kinder Morgan and some other pipelines. I guess on some level I should give them credit and say, I mean, they have finally, after so much, you know, consulting and conferencing, said, you know, okay, here's what we're doing about carbon pricing. And they have actually been pretty clear about that. We'll see, you know, how much of an obstacle Saskatchewan and some other provinces are going to be to their announced plans for a national carbon price that will ultimately scale up to $50 a ton within a few years. But so that has happened. Another thing is based on what they've said on the issue, I think we can expect marijuana legislation probably within the next couple of months.
But based on what they've said, yeah.
Based on what they've said in the past, on what they've said about when we can expect this, if not by the end of the year, then I would say probably sometime in like early 2017, we're going to get more of a sense of what the actual.
The health minister, when she went to the UN, sort of punched a clock there for 1 year, and that was in February. So
yes, yeah.
No, I mean, I think you're right there, but the thing about that is, like, the marijuana legalization was, as we may recall, literally the first commitment that came out of Trudeau,
true.
When he was running for Liberal leader, because there was a joke I remember at that time is that no one knew what he stood for other than legal marijuana, right? That was his whole thing. Mm-hmm. You could say that, you know, that's a good thing, that's progress, but I guess here's what I would say is maybe the conundrum about why the popularity remains so high even as these are coming out. And I agree with you that part of it may be that just hasn't had time to sink in terms of like what to say. But like if you look at who is you know, I think the Young Workers Forum is really indicative of this because like obviously, you know, I broadly probably agree with the politics of these people, but these are people that were highly skeptical of this government to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. And I would say the same thing about the other constituencies that they've managed to broadly alienate over the course of this last few months. The other one, big one, of course, being First Nations, mm-hmm. Who I think, based on my conversations with people and just based on reading statements that were coming out, there was kind of a very cautious, skeptical approach to this. And then when you have, you know, Jody Wilson-Raybould going to the AFN meeting and saying, you know, UNDRIP is unworkable, it sort of vindicates what people already believe to be the case. And I mean, for all the discussion about, the idea that the Liberals were pushing about having this nation-to-nation relationship, and for all the kind of initial idea that people had that, that there was a force, that there was going to be a much more productive relationship. I think if you look at the actual voting patterns of First Nations people in the last election, it's very instructive that even when the NDP vote went down quite a bit, most First Nations voters still voted New Democrat. So, I mean, all that's just to say, and not that I'm trying to make some political statement there, I'm just trying to say that, like, these are groups that were already not particularly attached to the Liberal Party and didn't form a kind of core element of the thing. They were people who, they were, if they were ever on the bandwagon, they were going to be the first to jump off anyway.
For sure. And to be clear, what I was saying is not so much that, like, yes, like, I'm not saying that, you know, the loss of the support of the people, like specifically in the demographic they represent, who challenged Trudeau at the Young Workers Forum, represents this like sudden eruption of opposition. It's more just that to be frank, like I think that part of why Trudeau has been has maintained such a long honeymoon, it's abnormally long, I think it's two things. I think that for one thing, it's just the fact that he hasn't really had to make any difficult decisions yet. I mean, like I said, but also, frankly, to the fact that he's been like exceptionally good at playing the media. Very, very good at sort of like playing and in some senses even circumventing the media through, you know, viral images and just seems to have he and his communication team just seem to have a much better understanding of the sort of modern media ecosystem than any previous prime minister. And through that you've had things where like, you know, That video of him explaining quantum computing that to me has been kind of representative of what kind of media stories the Trudeau government has been generating for about the past year. So I'm more just interested to see what impact the media coverage of this week has. And admittedly, maybe it might not be that much. I mean, I'll be frank and say, I mean, the action that happened on Monday that I was involved in, it was covered by the Ottawa Citizen. It was covered by a lot of activist media like Ricochet and actually Democracy Now! Down in the United States, of all things. But, I'm not 100% sure how much of an impact that had on sort of a broader news reading public, but I am still interested to see whether, I mean, even if it doesn't represent this like a sudden drop off in opinion, whether this might at least slightly change the media narrative around.
Well, I think that that's actually a very interesting point about not so much like the people, but it creates a sense of. Not so much that the people who jump, who were already really committed, start jumping off, but rather, as you say, there's a media narrative that starts getting built up about, like, quote, growing dissent against the government. Because the action you were part of, wasn't very covered outside of local media, but I do know that the Globe and Mail and the National Post and all the big papers did pick up the stuff at the Young Workers Forum.
Yeah, and the CBC.
And all these things. And actually had interviews with some of the people that were heckling him and some of the people that had turned their backs to him. Even if people don't necessarily agree with the politics of those people, I do think that it creates a situation where there's more, let's say, discursive space, and people are less willing to just go along with what the government's doing. I think there's a third factor to why he's had such a honeymoon beyond the two things you mentioned. It's that the two opposition parties are leaderless, kind of rudderless. He hasn't really faced very effective opposition in the parliament, right? And he won't until 2017, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a third factor that you have to consider there is, you know, when both the New Democrats and the Conservatives have interim leaders and they're trying to work out their own internal dynamics, I think that because of that, they've been unable to mount really effective oppositions to the government in the parliament. And because of the way the media narrative works, if there isn't that opposition in the parliament, it's seen as there isn't really opposition to something, right?
Yeah, you know, you've got a point there.
So I think that's another big factor to kind of play in. But I think the other thing I kind of want to spin on this is that there is this kind of inside-outside perception to a lot of what happens in the government. Because, you know, like I kind of referenced, there is this long-standing narrative, particularly in the U.S., the classic alienated liberal, I'm moving to Canada threat, which has really been very much sort of compounded by the Trudeau government. And I guess I'm curious to if you have a read on like why it is that is it just because they're not aware of some of these issues that are coming up, or is it just they want to have somebody that represents their political beliefs in an active governing fashion? But why do you think there's really been this kind of romance between maybe the center left at the very least, globally, and Trudeau?
I think because he just represents this kind of, at a time when so many countries are like I think maybe like actually if it comes down to one issue that maybe explains why this sort of left of center seems to be in love with Trudeau around the world. I think the one issue it might boil down to is like Syrian refugees. Mm. Like whereas you have so many countries that have governments that have been so at best tepid about taking them in. You know, Trudeau has kind of stepped up and said, you know, yes, this is Canada. We're a land of refuge and sanctuary, and all these people can come in, and so they kind of like I think it's mainly just that they project onto Trudeau what they wish their own leaders were doing, and also just. He just there's a lot of other things like, you know, like even down in the U.S., you know, I mean, like, obviously, you know, you compare like Trump to Trudeau, it's no contest. But even Clinton just kind of seems like old and, you know, connected to this sort of cynical political machine, which I mean, even her most fervent supporters, I think, you know, aren't going to try and argue that she's some sort of, you know, youthful, hopeful, transformative candidate in the mold of say Obama, which on the contrary I think Trudeau has kind of tapped into. And also just the fact that like it's this new government, so they've got like at least 4 years, well I guess at this point 3 years ahead of them to you know do all these things. So whereas you know other countries are either dominated by you know conservatives who you know don't embody this sort of open multicultural view of the world that many on the center left enjoy, and even in those countries where they're sort of left of center party, whether it's you know the Democrats who are probably going to win the U.S. election, or even the Parti Socialiste in France, you know. These center-left parties are kind of, you know, either perceived to be on their way out or as just kind of old and drained, whereas, like, you know, Justin represents this youthful, future-oriented left-of-center agenda.
Yeah, well, I think it's instructive when you think about the refugee situation because, like, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, you can point at the government for taking in people, but the thing is, if you look on a per capita basis, like, it's actually a pretty weak performance, right? I mean, and it's very interesting that, like, you know, say what you will about Angela Merkel, but, like, that's a far bigger commitment in terms of taking people in. Mm-hmm. Or Sweden, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Sweden per capita has taken far more people in than Canada. And nobody is going around making memes about Stefan Löfven, right? And, now, I would love that. That would be hilarious. But, like, you know, nobody's doing that. But I think you kind of hit on something. You said it is an image factor, that he is a young guy, a younger guy, I should say. He's telegenic. You know, he it doesn't, even though, I mean, it's sort of ironic because he's the you know, he's descended from a political, you know, dynasty, but he doesn't appear connected to these centers of power in, like, a very kind of cynical, transactional way mm-hmm. that people like Clinton or, you know, other kind of establishment center-left types can.
Yeah, and I mean, well, actually, not that she, and actually, like, for instance, what you mentioned, like, Merkel, like, yes, like, if you actually look at it, I mean, and particularly given the domestic situation in Germany, that she really is kind of, does seem to be going out on a branch to support, you know, to support and welcome refugees. I mean, yeah, arguably what she's doing is much more significant than Trudeau's stand on this issue. But again, I mean, she, as an individual, I mean, I feel like, I mean, maybe not the center-left, but certainly, like other people who are to the left of center, you know, if you follow the distinction, you know, are still kind of sore on her after you know the whole Greece saga.
Yes.
So like that's the thing is like, and this is where I would just like to sort of reemphasize what I'm saying is, you know, not just the, you know, he has nice hair and everything, although he does have that, not and you know he's good at playing the media, but it's just that he has not yet acquired the baggage that so many other left of center figures across the developed world have from their long involvement in politics.
Well, yeah, well, I think that's a big factor, too, is because, like, with somebody like Clinton, for example, is like, even if you're enthusiastic about Clinton, you have to explain, like, why did she say this stuff about super predators in the 90s? Why did she vote for the Iraq War? Why did she?
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you're somebody who, and I guess the biggest thing right now is, like, if you look at Europe, the center-left has been the biggest victim of this sort of, you know, the post-crisis sort of political dynamics, right? You have a situation where the emerging currents are nationalist right, you know, a kind of center-right party that manages to cling on to power through some kind of combination of voter loyalty and various, you know, sort of economic dynamics, and then a, like...
And pandering to the far right.
What's that? And pandering to the far right, yes, of course.
Sarko.
Yeah, Sarko, I mean, you can look at a number of situations where this is the case. Denmark would be another, Finland would be the... and the other thing being a sort of emergent radical left current, so
yep.
You're Jeremy Corbyn, right?
Yes.
And I think that if you're somebody that doesn't, you know, doesn't, that rejects that sort of politics, but the, you know, dynamic of the central left is not really holding, you're going to start looking for, you know, where it does seem to be holding. And I think that's, and it, there's also just, I think in that comes a temptation to not flip the rock over and see what's actually going on. So I think that kind of explains the kind of outside.
So what we're saying is Trudeau, champion of the Blairites.
I mean, you know, in a way, right? Like, that is the real policy framework that they're working in, is this kind of old, like, you know, it now seems kind of ironic to say, but old school third way mentality, right?
Wow.
Is, you know, and, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, like, remember when that was the emergent tendency in center left politics,
yep,
was Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, this, you know, these kinds of ideas.
Gretchen Martin,
yeah, to a degree as well. And that's really what Trudeau's doing. And I think, you know, I will be fair. He is to the left of Gretchen Martin.
That's absolutely true.
I'll be fair about that. But that's also just more speaks to the political dynamic, like the kind of political and economic dynamics that are at work. There isn't a deficit hysteria the way there was then. Mm-hmm. There isn't, you know, a run on the Canadian dollar the way there was then. Economic growth is sluggish but growing, and there doesn't seem to be a real sort of mass political concern with reducing deficits, right? So I think that he's given some space to be able to, you know, do things like invest in infrastructure, do things like that. And I mean, you know, all those are positive things. But like you say, I think that there's going to be within the next few years, and I hope that, you know, the opposition parties are able to kind of more highlight a lot of these contradictions moving forward, and then you think. But I mean, part of the problem too is that no one really seems to know who's going to be leading those opposition parties, what they're going to be doing. I mean, if Bernier becomes conservative leader, we're going to be hearing a lot about how, you know, we got to break up the maple syrup cartels, and not so much about, you know, First Nations rights or something. And then, you know, I mean, the New Democrats, who knows what's going to happen there. So, I mean, I think that a lot of the decisions that are going to be forced on them are going to be made of necessity, but it really, as to a question of whether that actually reduces their political potency, it's really a question of how the opposition parties can capitalize on them. Because the other thing that Trudeau has managed to do, that a lot of Liberal governments managed to do, is that they really harness their own policy priorities and their own actions and their own narrative of how the world works to a really kind of national identity kind of thing.
Yes.
And I think that
Canada is back.
Canada is back. And the whole idea of, like, I mean, if you want to steal a line from Hillary Clinton, Canada is great because Canada is good. And there's this kind of internal, you know, to a degree, mythology that people want to believe in, that they can sort of write things out as if they don't fit into that narrative. And I think
it's
what this
sort of soft left nationalist thing, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's really what plays into at least some of the dynamics that work in terms of the polling. But with all that said, I think that, you know, tonight, as we record this, there's going to be a debate in the House of Commons about one of the other things and the innumerable number of problems, the fact that the government doesn't seem to be complying with the Human Rights Tribunal ruling.
Yep.
About services for First Nations children on reserve. And I, you know, this was a debate being forced by the New Democrats, specifically MP Charlie Angus. And I guess, you know, that's really indicative of the problem here, is that there is a willingness to talk about things. There's a willingness to have these consultations. But when the rubber hits the road, they seem to be really kind of unwilling to spend money or to engage in sort of political, like using their political capital in a way that doesn't, you know, fit in with this broader dynamics that we're working out of the Harper government. And I think, and previous to that as well. So, I mean, you know, we'll see. But I guess I just wanted to get your impression of, like, what, you know, you think the next few years hold in terms of policy decisions and in terms of what actually happens. Because the other thing I wanted to mention quickly is that they also appear to be backing off of voting reform.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we mustn't forget about that.
Yeah, so anyway, just I'll throw to you on that.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think it kind of shows that, based on some of their commitments and what they have done and what they seem to be signaling that they're going to do, I feel like what we're going to see is, you know, very, very, very much sort of tinkering around the edges of the sort of Harper agenda. And I don't want, and to be perfectly fair to the Liberals and to the apparently quite numerous, you know, Trudeau supporters who might be listening to this, I'm not saying that in the sense that there's absolutely no change, but that the change is more on things that are peripheral to sort of the larger structures of the economy and our politics. So, you know, for instance, on the environment, he still seems very much committed to this. I mean, I don't know if he's really used the rhetoric, but something that you know, Harper was always talking about is wanting to turn Canada into an energy superpower. So, you know, he's willing to get fairly tough in terms of putting a price on carbon, but underneath that, still, like, probably going to approve a number of pipelines and try to get, you know, tar sands oil being exported to Asia, to the United States, to, you know, wherever he can find a market for it. And again, like, we will see, you know, I mean, ultimately moving towards, like, legalization of marijuana and a lot of stuff that's kind of on the more... Not to dismiss the legalization of marijuana. I mean, it's obviously important. You know, people are not going to be people are not going to be getting, you know, put in jail for the possession of a relatively harmless drug, and that's definitely progress. But I think that you know they have that the Trudeau government is ultimately going to be one that's more, you know, based on relatively technocratic tinkering, as opposed to any kind of fundamental shifts that would risk upsetting the sort of long-term trends in Canadian society and our economy, and also perhaps not quite as willing to, you know, challenge, like, entrenched interests like the tar sands and the oil industry and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the other thing, but I guess the fundamental thing is, like, I feel like the people who would make that sort of case, like, saying this is what the reality is, are the kind of people who were making this case, like, during the election too, like the whole idea of the whole idea of, like, you know, what they were promising, if you really looked into it, was just this sort of technocratic tinkering around the edges, right? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we could argue about, was any party offering any kind of more fundamental shift? I mean, that's another argument. But just to say that I think there may have been a projection of what at least some percentage of the voting public wanted to see in the government, and just this craving to get out of Harper those years, and to make it that any shift out of that is a definitive shift out of that, and we must, you know, believe in this idea because it, again, I think it suits our own self-image.
Yeah, well, and I mean, to be clear, you know, I actually, you know, I mean, read the environmental platforms, at least, of each of the parties. And yeah, I mean, Trudeau never really, even in the election, never really committed to anything more than, you know, having some conferences and trying to establish a national price on carbon, you know, in cooperation with the provinces, which he has now said that he's going to do. So yes, I mean, absolutely. If I sound at all disappointed in the government, it's yeah. I mean, to be perfectly fair, it's not that they've. I mean, except maybe on the issue of electoral reform, because they're...
Well, we'll see on that, and then
we'll see where that goes.
Well, and then also, I mean, the other thing is, I was going to say, is, like, if you actually look at their commitments, they have not actually, like, quote, broken promises other than to First Nations.
Yeah.
And also potentially electoral reform. We'll see what
happens. Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, so, like, yeah, that's the thing. It's not that they haven't broken promises, it's just that, you know... I mean, I don't know. At the risk of, you know, sounding kind of cliched here, I mean, you know, how real is some of this change when you get down to it?
Of course, of course. Yeah. So I think that about covers it for that. Is there anything that you kind of wanted to add just before we go to the next segment?
No, I think I've said about all I have to say on the subject.
Okay, well, we will welcome, I think that the thing that'll be interesting moving forward is just once we actually have some leaders at the head of both the NDP and the Conservatives, it'll be interesting to see how the political debate develops at that point, because I think that's when the media is going to actually really start paying attention, once you start seeing some, you know, legitimate fireworks in the House, and you start seeing people campaigning against each other in terms of that. Because unfortunately, I think the media tends to work in this frame of, if there isn't, like, organized political party opposition to something, there is no opposition to something. So I think
by and large.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you'll start to see more of that moving forward. And, you know, who knows what happens to the polling numbers. I mean, I would say the money at this point is still probably on them winning the next election. But, you know, 3 years is a long time.
Yeah. I do not feel at all in a position to predict something as far off as the next election, but yeah, okay, we'll see.
Well, we will stay tuned for that. Okay, and we are back on the Affairs Current with I guess a discussion on the Battle for Mosul, greatest invention in live stream warfare of the 21st century. But I will allow Edward to begin.
Yeah. So going to you know, the third debate moderator Chris Wallace described as a foreign hotspot. You know, the battle for Mosul. So this is kind of in a way, what we've really kind of been building towards over the, like, 2 years of sustained declared war against ISIS. I mean, because it was fundamentally 2 years ago, the execution of hostages, but also the conquest of Mosul by ISIS that actually kind of put them on the map and took them from being, you know, just another group involved in the sort of omnidirectional Syrian civil war into, you know, the new Al-Qaeda or what have you.
It was, Obama might put it, move them up from the JV team legs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, and well, two years later, here we are. Some, 30,000 government... not actually government, not the actual security forces. I mean, they play a role, but government-aligned troops from, Kurds coming in from sort of the north and the north to, you know, well, actual government forces to various Shiite militias and handful of sort of Sunni Arab tribal groups are finally moving in on Mosul under American air cover. And, there's no real indication that, ISIS has the wherewithal to actually defend the city. So, at the same time that no one is claiming that, it's going to fall tomorrow, there does seem to be a pretty general consensus that this is the beginning of the end of ISIS's occupation of Iraq's second largest city and one of its most important symbolic victories since it erupted onto the world stage. So I think it is worth talking about what this is going to mean. What does the world and the campaign against ISIS look like once it's, been driven out of its last major stronghold in Iraq? What does that do for Iraq? So I think there's, I think it is worth discussing.
Yeah. So, I think, first of all, you're quite right to say that, this would be driving it out of Iraq, right? But I think that part of the problem that's been noted is, the border between Iraq and Syria has effectively been erased by this conflict.
Yeah. Right?
So, it is true that if Iraq can regain, control over its own territory, that's a big victory for Iraq there. And in terms of being able to coordinate things better, in terms of being able to, have a recognition of, okay, we have a border, we can enforce it, that kind of thing. Obviously, that's important. And obviously, if you restrict ISIS to Syrian territory, you might have a better ability to figure out some way of coordinating these groups in such a way that you could really start to take it on. Because I do think that one of the things that's very interesting about this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, other people can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this does represent really the first time you've seen a real effort to coordinate all of the actors on the ground
yeah.
in a concerted push against ISIS to do one particular mission, right? I think something that we've noted in discussing this, and other people have noted as well, has been the problem of all these groups having very divergent interests in terms of what they want out of fighting ISIS. So therefore, I think if this is successful, which it does appear like it will be, the question of success, to me, is more a question of how many people do these, coalition, for the sake of just simplifying it, allied forces, how many people do they lose, and in what proportions mm-hmm. Do each of the groups, the relative groups, lose them to do this? Because I think it's kind of a foregone conclusion, just not based on strength of numbers and things, and the fact that they have U.S. air support, that ISIS will be driven out.
Even ISIS, at the same time that they're putting out propaganda videos trying to make it look like Mosul is fine and there's no fighting going on, the reports we're getting is that they are using basically suicide car attacks as an actual tactical military weapon. So when you're literally having your fighters blow themselves up to try to inflict casualties on the enemy, this suggests to me that you're not super confident in your ability to sustain conventional warfare for a long period.
Well, I think this is, yeah, and I think that's the thing, is at that point it really becomes not so much an exercise in holding territory, it becomes an exercise in inflicting casualties and trying to demoralize your enemy, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what been one of the big noted problems is this demoralization factor, because ISIS, one of the things that I think I referenced this before we talked about ISIS, is that one of the things that makes it very hard to dislodge radically revolutionary states is that the people who are fighting for those states really, really believe in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, people underestimate the role of that kind of morale in terms of achieving things, right? I mean, the analogy I always go back to is every single global power was allied against the Soviet Union, the Russian Soviet the Russian Federal Soviet Republic in the initial point of the Russian Civil War, the Bolshevik. and the Bolsheviks won, right? Despite everybody else being allied against them. And that was largely because they had a devoted cadre of very, very devoted people who thought that they had history on their side. And I think that's the other thing you have to remember with ISIS. Now, the difference is, of course, they didn't have like massive amounts of air power. They didn't have all these kind of new technological innovations and really huge technology gap between ISIS and the U.S. Yeah. military, things like that. So, like, that makes it more likely that you can dislodge ISIS, right? But it does point to the same sort of logical conundrum, which is that, you know, we'll see how many people have to die to take Mosul back, right? Mm-hmm. And that will... And also, depending on how it gets spun and how, you know, the relative proportion of the casualties, because that's the other thing, is if one of these groups, just so let's say the Kurds, sees themselves as taking the brunt of the casualties in this conflict, that could very well split the logic of the thing. And the other thing is, even if you get them out of Iraq, there's a real question of, do the people who are involved in that want to go further and push into Syria and try to do that, or are they just going to say, okay, we just want to secure our border? Because I suspect that that's probably what the Iraqi government's, you know, main objective is, just get that border secured, and then, you know, let the rest of it do what it will, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem with that is, of course, from that point, ISIS might be able to rebuild and push back in. And then it's a question of, okay, what is the morale of the actual Iraqi security forces, which has been notably quite low.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think what was it like? Ash Carter, who's the U.S. Defense Secretary, said like people were just dropping their guns or something to this effect. So, you know, this is a real conundrum. Now, I do think that, on the other hand, I do think that if there is a coordinated push to get them out of Mosul, that is a big victory symbolically. Is it a purely symbolic victory? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, it gives just because it's the last Iraqi city, it does kind of push them out. The problem is, like, their headquarters and stuff are in Syrian territory,
yeah, absolutely,
where they draw most of their financial capital from in terms of both the oil and also the selling of ancient artifacts and various things are in Syria. So there is still that conundrum, and most of the foreign fighters that go to fight with ISIS go to Syria.
Yeah, right? pass through Turkey.
Pass through Turkey and go to Syria. So, anyway.
But yeah, I do think it is at least slightly more than symbolic, because, I mean, you know, ever fewer people having to live under ISIS rule. I mean,
of course, I don't mean to, like, I'm...
Yeah, sorry, but yeah, so, yeah. I mean, like, it is definitely, like, it's a fantastic day, especially for the... you know, the religious minorities that live in and around Mosul. So that's excellent. It is actually interesting that I have actually seen, like, apparently Ash Carter is actually saying that, you know, it's like next stop Raqqa after this, which is the Syrian de facto capital of the Islamic State. I can only imagine like how he envisions that happening. There are the Syrian Kurds with whom the United States does have a reasonably successful sort of partnership in terms of, you know, them acting as ground forces to the United States air power, although how that, you know, so that it's possible, but I somehow doubt that the fall of Raqqa will be is as much of a foregone conclusion as the fall of Mosul, and I do think you know kind of what is the kind of the next question that will follow after, you know, the liberation of Mosul. I think you kind of touched on it when you said, you know, I mean, if the Kurds, for instance, you know, feel that they've taken a disproportionate impact of the casualties inflicted on coalition forces, that it could lead to kind of a break, and I think it's absolutely entirely possible that you know, even once Mosul is retaken, that doesn't mean that, you know, Mosul will just go back to being a perfectly normal, peaceful, happy place where, you know, people aren't getting killed anymore. Actually, you know, the article which I kind of shared with Carter before, and which I will be on the which will be on our site for you to find a link to if you want. But it's actually the author makes the point that, you know, I mean, this isn't the first time, obviously, that Mosul has changed hands. I mean, you know, like, obviously, first it, you know, was reconquered from the Iraqi government by ISIS. But, you know, before that, I mean, there was actually a brief point during the Iraq War proper where it had been taken over by Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And even before that, just, I mean, literally when the Kurdish forces allied to the Americans first took it from the army of Saddam Hussein, that itself led to a great deal of looting, which, of course, the Kurds blamed on the Arabs and the Arabs blamed on the invading Kurds, and a great deal of ethnic tension. Because, I mean, Mosul is itself kind of on the outer edge, you know, near sort of, if you will, the border between what could be considered Iraqi Kurdistan and the more like Arab Sunni part of Iraq. And so I think, for instance, that even if ISIS can no longer hold as a kind of, you know, stable pseudo state entity the territory of Mosul, I think it's entirely possible that even once it is liberated, you will continue to see terrorist attacks by various groups, including ISIS itself. Although, in a way, that is almost kind of the depressing norm for Iraq, because I feel like, well, maybe people realize this, maybe they don't, but even before, you know, ISIS came and took over a great deal of Iraqi territory, even in the, you know, supposedly sort of golden age between, you know, the withdrawal of American troops and the rise of ISIS, you know, Iraq has
Had car bombings on a daily basis.
Car bombings, assassinations. I mean, there has been, like, since the invasion of 2003, there has not been a time in which Iraq was not subject to a level of violence which, you know, we in Canada would consider a, you know, a prelude to civil war. It's so intense in terms of the terrorist violence. So it's, you know, yeah, I'm not, you know, obviously there are a lot of ethnic tensions and sort of general questions about the stability of the state, which will linger on after the liberation of Mosul.
I think what it comes down to for me in terms of the question of Iraq, the other question, Syria, I'll just get to in one second, is that, like, I think it's instructive to look at how Al-Qaeda in Iraq was defeated and in terms of making these alliances and city awakening and all this kind of thing. Because the thing was, I think there was an opportunity at that point to build some kind of government that was going to be reasonably accommodatory to the different ethnic groups and different interest groups and all that kind of thing. And they threw it away.
Yeah. Right?
And I hope that, you know, if this is a moment where the Iraqi government can represent it as being, okay, we've come together, Kurds, Sunni, Shia, we've come together to get rid of ISIS, push them out of Mosul, I hope that this time, you know, they and you know, their various handlers, you know, say, like, okay, but you have to actually build something out of this that creates stability in the long term, that makes it so that people feel some kind of, even if they're not super, like, even if their main loyalty might still be to some subgroup, they still feel some level of loyalty to the central government, so that they are willing to defend the country if and when ISIS might try to come back in. Question of Syria.
I wonder if I could just come in off that. I will say, you know, I think there is at least the possibility that we could see a more inclusive government and at least, you know, could, because let's be frank, the previous Iraqi prime minister, who kind of got the boot after he lost large portions of the country to ISIS, was Nouri al-Maliki, who was very much, I suppose maybe the best way to describe him was, I mean, he was a Shiite supremacist. He, you know, under the sort of rhetorical cloak of de-Bothification, he purged Sunnis from large swaths of the government. And then actually, people again, maybe don't remember this as well, but at the time when the Arab Spring was happening, there were actually somewhat analogous protests in Iraq,
yes,
from Sunnis who felt disenfranchised by the central government. And Maliki's response was basically just straight up brutality to suppress these protests. So, but now that Maliki is gone, and that his replacement, Haider al-Abadi, is at least notionally committed to a less sectarian Iraq, although of course it still remains to be seen how he handles the sort of post-liberation reconciliation. There is, at the very least, the possibility of building a Iraq where there is a truly national sense of belonging rather than these sort of sectarian divisions. But that's definitely under the category of wait and see.
Yeah. And then just to speak to the Ashkoder next stop, Raqqa. So the problem is with Syria is that basically when you're talking about trying to get ISIS out of Iraq, you have a situation where the central government, however weak and fractious it may be, is aligned with you, right?
Yeah.
And has the same goals that you do, is going to let you operate in its airspace, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. Syria, no. Assad is not going to let Assad and also Putin are not going to let, U.S. fighter jets or bombers operate in Syria's airspace, right? That would, and all these people going, well, just, keep going. Like, do you want to cause World War III? Like, so there's that issue. The second issue is that, the second issue is that, unlike in the situation in Mosul, in Iraq, in Syria, there's, the dynamics of the various groups are so intertwined and so overlapping, and you have Russia in there. The other thing is that a lot of the opposition to ISIS comes from other Islamist groups,
yeah,
which is not really the case in Iraq, at least in this Mosul case. So that creates a real problem for trying to figure out who you actually want to support in, if you were going to say, okay, let's retake Raqqa. It's like, who is the let us do something. Who is the us in that,
yeah,
in that thing? Because, in the case of Mosul, who do you want to be the actual government that's going to have notional control over Mosul? It's the Iraqi central government. In Syria, who do you want to have control over Raqqa? Well, U.S. policy is not to allow Assad to have control over it or ISIS to have control over it. Is their policy still notionally that, like, the Free Syrian Army is the legitimate government of Syria? Is that still notionally the case?
I think so, but
okay,
who even knows?
TBD on that, but, like, the point is that the policy is very confusing.
Yeah, and
in my opinion,
and kind of pie in the sky,
and kind of pie in the sky,
even to the extent that it is clearly formulated.
Yeah. Now, of course, that's the stated policy. There's obviously the unstated policy, which at this point seems to be evolving to some kind of, like, they want to make some kind of face-saving measure with Assad to do something, either just get some lower-level person in there or something. The problem is, I feel like until that's openly articulated, like, people are going to be seeking reassurances. The other thing is, of course, there's an election in the U.S., which I think, regardless of which of the two people gets elected, you're going to have a different policy on Syria.
Yeah, than that has been the case under Obama.
Yeah, and I mean, different in different ways, depending on if Mr. Trump or Ms. Clinton gets elected. But just to say that, there is a kind of, I mean, I almost feel somewhat cynically that the Obama administration's policy on this is kind of trying to get Iraq secured and then kind of run out the clock on Syria, because it's so complicated that they're going to try to just pass it to whoever the next person is. But if Ashkoder is saying next stop Raqqa, then maybe, I don't know, like, that, either that's for rhetorical effect or they have a plan. I don't know.
Yeah. Although, again, the only stable, reliable group in Syria that, you know, is not basically advertising their desire to, you know, commit yet more war crimes and use whatever territory they gain and or use whatever territory they gain as a launching pad for, you know, attacking other countries, is the Kurds.
Who don't want to govern the country.
Who don't want to govern the country. I mean, you know, out of, I guess, fairness to Ash Carter, who apparently has some kind of plan. I mean, Raqqa is not within Syrian Kurdistan, but it is kind of adjacent to it. So it is conceivable that the Kurds could play a role in dislodging ISIS from Raqqa, in the same way that the Iraqi Kurds have played a role in dislodging ISIS from Mosul. But it's not clear who else is going to be in that and who's actually going to hold it once they get out. Because, as you say, I mean, there are a handful of smaller groups who of smaller rebel groups who do sort of broadly share commitment to liberal, democratic, Western, if you will, principles. But I mean, again, like next to ISIS, one of the most powerful rebel groups is the artist formerly known as the al-Nusra Front. I forget what they're called now, but it's something slightly different, who are literally al-Qaeda, actual Qutbists. Yeah. So, you know, that's fantastic.
Yeah, well, and then, I mean, when you get to the point where David Petraeus was suggesting, you know, why don't we just arm the al-Nusra Front? Would that be... So, I mean, this sort of illustrates the conundrum that you're in. But nevertheless, I do think that, you know, obviously liberating Mosul will be very good for the people living there and will be, you know, good as far as securing the territorial integrity of Iraq. The wider question of what it leads to really depends on both in terms of Iraq creating political and social stability, which they've sort of shown themselves to be kind of trying at being able to do. And then in terms of Syria, I really still think that there's a massive coordination problem of who you actually want to govern the territory that ISIS currently occupies.
I mean, hey, you never know. Maybe President Trump will, you know, join Putin's anti-Hitler coalition, and, you know, peace will be won in Syria over the, you know,
create a desert, call it peace. I believe that's what that is.
Yeah. So, I mean, I hope not.
Well, we can only pray. Yeah. So with that, we will move on to recommended reading. Okay, we're back here to wrap up with the recommended readings, and I will let Edward go first.
So, actually, for I think the first time that I've been on this podcast, my recommended reading, I mean, if I have done this before, then, you know, someone with more free time can correct me, it is an actual book. It's a book called American Nations by Colin Woodard. Which is just, very, I think, relevant to, really to American politics in general and to the, you know, sort of apotheosis of American politics that is the, you know, quadrennial presidential election we're currently going through. So what is this book? This book is basically, you know, it's sort of subtitled as basically like this history of what he identifies as the 11 regional cultures in North America. So actually not just the United States, but also Canada. And it's basically a very methodical breakdown of what he refers to as nations that make up basically English speaking North America, well, plus Quebec. And so, you know, it's, I could list off all 11, but that would go longer than we typically go in a recommended reading. But just to give you an idea of why I think this is so relevant, you know, at this point when people are wondering aloud, you know, who's still supporting Trump, you know, if you actually go on, say, God, what's Nate Silver's?
Like, 538.
538, right? I always forget the number. Anyway, like if you go on like 538.org, or whatever the address is, and look at like the states that, despite everything, are still projected to vote Republican in the upcoming election. And if you compare it to the analysis that Woodward puts forth in his book, they map almost exactly onto what he calls the nations of the Deep South, Greater Appalachia, and the Far West. And so that just gives you an idea of you know, I mean, there are a number of other nations. He talks about the West Coast, you know, the Left Coast, the, you know, sort of Greater New England, stuff like that. And as much as this all sounds like something out of, you know, some kind of, you know, alternate history thing out of Harry Turtledove, these are actually very, very well grounded, very well researched explanations of the regional cultures that make up the United States. You know, I just recommend it because I find it's a great way to kind of, you know, put some order into all the different ways that people talk geographically about American politics, whether it's, you know, red and blue and purple states, or, you know, the coasts and flyover country. So it's a great analytical tool that I think goes a long way towards explaining sort of, you know, where the hardest core of Trump support in this election remains.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so my recommended reading is an article from New York Magazine, and it's basically an article about, you know, a common thing that I like to bring up on these podcasts, which is Yemen, but it's specifically asking the question of why has there been no debate about Yemen in the current U.S. presidential election, because, you know, not only now is there, you know, an alliance between Saudi Arabia and the United States, and Saudi Arabia is bombing Yemen with a lot of, you know, in many cases, U.S. Manufactured weapons or weapons that have been sold to Saudi Arabia by the U.S., but recently, the U.S. itself actually performed an airstrike on Yemen as a result of, I believe, it's like a missile was shot at one of their boats. And anyway, it was kind of a, you know, some might call it a Gulf of Tonkin type of a situation. But nevertheless, you know, so now the U.S. at least, I mean, they only did, it was one sort of thing. But obviously, you know, the drone program was going on there a very long time. So it's basically asked, the article is asking the question, like, why is this not really being brought up at all in the U.S. presidential election? I mean, I think it's just very illustrative of the prerogatives and priorities of kind of the way foreign policy is debated, that this isn't getting brought up, because unlike Mosul, for example, it's not a hot topic, it's not serving somebody else's interest, it's not a situation where Americans feel some kind of threat coming from Yemen, no matter how abstract in the way that ISIS is. But then also just the article kind of goes into an analysis of like where the candidates like actually seem to stand on these issues. And I mean, I think the description of Trump's position is quite sort of funny, and also kind of puts live to this idea that seems to be out there in the culture that, you know, Trump is some kind of dove or some kind of neo-realist. You know, I don't, for reasons that the article explains, and which I also think are obvious from the way he talks about bombing things and whatnot, I think that's obviously false, but I'll allow you to kind of make that judgment for yourself. Anyway, it's a very interesting article from New York Magazine, and it is something that I think needs to be talked about in this election, but unfortunately is not, and, you know, really should be sort of asking the questions about, like, why, you know, it is that the U.S. continues to stand four square behind Saudi Arabia when it's doing things like performing, I think, in a world first, the first triple tap airstrike. So that's just lovely. As we discussed before on this podcast, and as I've written about in some other places, this is really just a humanitarian disaster. And I think that, you know, beyond any sort of analysis you want to do geopolitically, I think that is, it's a really underreported upon and underremarked upon kind of disaster, because it doesn't have wider geopolitical implications in the way a lot of these other things do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, beyond everything that Carter outlined about you know, what the article says about why that, you know, the media isn't really talking about this, and why, frankly, it should be, I think that this reality of it being ignored also kind of shows that the way that so much of the political media in the United States really only seems to take an interest in an issue when it becomes something, when it becomes a partisan issue. The sort of classical formulation is that, like, broadly speaking, if there's an issue on which both parties or both parties' nominees basically agree, it's almost not debated unless unless there's significant pressure from outside the partisan system, from, you know, public opinion or what have you, which, you know, briefly did make, say, for instance, mass surveillance a subject of debate, even though both major parties are basically on the same page with it. Whether it's, you know, both parties agree, or, you know, one party has a position and the other party, as personified in Trump, probably couldn't even find Yemen on a map and doesn't especially care to, I think it just kind of shows how navel-gazing and driven by sort of partisan horse race politics a lot of the election coverage and debate is in the United States.
Well, yeah, and I also just think it kind of gives you this idea of, like, once you sort of step out of that that sort of ideological, if I may use the term, hot box of this election cycle, and once you step outside of that and you're not covering, like, who's up, who's down, does this leaked tape, do these leaked emails hurt one candidate or the other, you can kind of recognize the absurdity of this election in particular, but maybe more generally you could say that, but I mean, I would definitely say this election in particular, the absurdity of the questions that are actually being debated, because frankly, at this point, it's effectively become a referendum on, like, do you approve of toxic misogyny or not? And it really does lead to a lot of these questions about U.S. foreign policy really being neglected.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with that said, my name is Carter Vance, your host as always. I thank you for listening to this episode of The Affairs Current, and I thank Edward for being here with me. Do you have any final closing thoughts, Edward?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay, perfect. So our email is always theaffairscurrent@gmail.com, our blog, theaffairscurrent@blogspot.com, where we'll have all the links, news, everything to help you guide your way through this episode. And as always, I thank you and have a pleasant week.